Welcome to the DLA Piper Financial Services Podcast. This series discusses the big issues in financial services, providing market and legal insight into the latest trends and challenges in the sector.
Hello, I'm Mike Danilewski, a partner based in our Frankfurt office, and welcome to the first episode of the DLA Piper Financial Services Podcast series. Today I'm joined by my colleagues, David Empor, partner in our London office.
Hi everyone.
Arlene Johnston, legal director in our Dublin office.
Hi everyone.
Sébastien Précheux, partner in our Paris office.
Hello everyone.
In today's episode, we will be discussing the NPL regulatory landscape in Northern Europe. In the decade plus since the 2008 recession, the non-performing loans industry matured in many parts of the world, as we know, with loan sales and securitizations becoming commonplace for banks and a broadening pool of investors taking part in NPL transactions. But as the NPL market hit its stride, a global pandemic threatens to disrupt the balance. Before the COVID-19, as every one of us knows, much of the stocks of NPL grew out of the 2008 financial crisis, particularly in Europe. At its peak, as was reported, NPLs in Europe reached about 1.2 trillion. That number recently dropped to half, about 600 billion euros, according to the EBA. Perhaps a positive sign that banks have finally made a good progress in incorporating NPL and debt sales in their overall credit and risk strategy. Now, as a result of the pandemic, banks and lenders face unprecedented widespread loan defaults across the globe and numerous industries. And we think this could present opportunities for the investors seeking yield as the crowded field of risk-averse investors further depress returns from safe haven vehicles, but they may be ill-equipped to sort through a market saturated with distressed assets. Early regional forecasts on the rise of non-performing assets post-COVID-19 are substantial and suggest a sizable supply of NPLs for years to come. And this, of course, leads to the first question to Sébastien. How can issuers and banks, do you think, navigate the post-COVID-19 NPL landscape?
Well, thank you, Mike. I think you've forgotten someone else there, Mike. The regulators will actually and certainly play, as usual, a very big part in that too. So you do have the, in terms of regulation, the EU NPL, what we call the European package, which is under the ECB guidelines. So the ECB has played a very important part on that. This has been really what we call the regulatory response to this issue. So you have the implementation of this very important and substantial framework, which has actually been slightly delayed, of course, due to COVID, because all the credit institutions, all the significant institutions have been clearly focusing on a daily basis on the management of the crisis. So there are different steps in implementing that. Everything will not be implementing in one. So you will have the application to new loans, and then the application the following year to renegotiated, restructured loans, and then later in 2024, actually to all loans in the portfolio. So this will be a major change. The first measure actually of the EU package is clearly to try to set at least what we call an harmonized definition of the non-performing exposure, the NPE. So this is we are really going to hear a lot about this concept of NPE. That's really the universal European concept of default. And this will mean that actually all the significant institutions should have the same definition, the same trigger. And they will have to implement really a strategy in which the management will also be embedded. So the management of the credit institution will be embedded in the approval of the NPN plan and the implementation of such plan, which is very important to note here, is that it will require clearly an assessment which will be more specific, which will be more granular of the portfolio and the collateral. And we should say also that the other very important aspect of that is that you will have the concept of forbearance. You may certainly have heard all about that, but the concept of forbearance, clearly, what does it mean? It means that It's only when there is no sustainable restructuring solution that has been reached that the banks will be expected to enforce their rights. That could be through initiating the traditional legal procedures. That could be through foreclosing assets, through implementing a restructuring, through implementing the debt to asset or equity swap, to securitize, to assign in other ways the receivables. And all this will clearly have an impact on the documentation template. If you take the definition of the default, you take the definition of the non-performing exposure, we should expect some changes in the documentation on the financing side, and also, by the way, on the derivatives on the hedging side to reflect the lending aspects.
Okay. And what will actually be the next challenges for banks in terms of then these regulatory constraints?
Well, there will be a lot, and the banks are used since the beginning of the COVID crisis to manage quite a lot of expectations from the authorities on that. So there will be a lot of challenges. First of all, the banks will have to acquire a more substantial knowledge of their portfolio, which means really a granularity for the unsecured part. And they will have also to have and actually to set up an action plan. So they will have to incorporate this new regulatory package into the procedures, into their policies, which means involving not only the risk, the compliance department, the legal, but also the business and the management. This comes at the moment where they have already to implement the new CRD5, CRD2 package, which is still an important package to implement. They will have to identify the gaps, and they will have to make a reasoning at the level of the portfolio and an aggregate level, as usual. And in addition to CRD5, to CRD2, to this NPL package, they will have also at the same time to make sure this is consistent with the changes in the implementation of the new IFRS 9 accounting rules. So, and actually the IFR is a good example of interdependency between those regulations, because obviously all the concept of default, for instance, the NPE concept, has to be consistent under the accounting rules and under the new regulatory or legal rules. And again, you will have to have consistency between the documentation of financing, the capital market documentation for bond issuance, the hedging derivative documentation. And I should add also, in addition to that, that another challenge is also to take into account the sustainable finance, the new ESG criteria, which has to be implemented and which clearly has an impact on the calculation of the regulatory capital requirements for loan and the collateral valuation. So I would say all this has to be consistent, and clearly there is an interdependency between all this regulation, which clearly bring a sort of a new risk culture and a change into what we call the risk appetite of the banks and the market.
Okay, so let's cross the channel for a second and let's see what is the UK's perspective, since as we speak, the UK's reported NPL ratio is still below 5%. David, what do you see happening into 2021?
Thanks, Mike. Well, I think it's absolutely inevitable that the stock of NPLs in the UK will rise during the course of the next year, 2 years. Although, to my mind, I don't think the UK will be as badly affected as some other northern or indeed southern European countries. Clearly, the UK has the phenomenon of COVID-19 like everywhere else, but also of possible Brexit risk, which may create some concentrated risk around particular sectors and subsectors of the UK economy. I think in preparation for that increase in the NPL stock, we have seen, as we saw actually post the last global financial crisis, many of the UK-based banks have taken steps to provision early to seek to deal with possible problem exposures. So as we speak, you know, the provisions that have been made across the largest clearing banks in the UK, LBG have set aside about £4.2 billion in respect of bad loans. NatWest expects full-year impairments of between £3.5 billion and £4.5 billion. So these are chunky sums. So there's clearly an expectation that NPL stocks will rise. That provisioning process is absolutely critical as to what happens in the future and as to how those NPLs are dealt with, either through NPL sales or workouts or the like, but the provisioning process gives that flexibility, which will provide a stimulus to transactions. So in short, I certainly see an increase, and I'm seeing some preparedness on behalf of the banking sector here as to what will come in 2021.
Okay, so looking also into other measures, such like payment moratoria, and particularly interested in the question what impact on Irish banks such payment moratoria may have. So retail credit and credit servicing firms, and looking into the Irish sector for this, for 2021. Eileen, what is your view?
Thanks, Mike. So the latest report from the central bank is actually December 2020, and they reported then that there was about 175,000 loans had availed of a payment break. At that time, about 40% of those had gone on to a second payment break. And the report said at the end of October 2020, there was about 24,000 borrowers that were on active payment breaks. As you know, in December, the EBA reactivated its guidelines on payment moratoria, and they have been now extended to the 31st of March 2021. But these come with more restrictive measures than had originally been put in place. And it is now that people on moratoria can only be on such for a maximum of 9 months. And the banks need to be able to notify, in Ireland's case, the Central Bank of Ireland, of their plan and how they will assess the unlikeliness of the individual's ability to be able to repay. Much like David was saying in terms of the UK, Ireland in the last financial crisis learned many a lesson, and the banks are prepared, I believe, in the current circumstances. Now, granted, nobody saw COVID-19 coming down the tracks, but they do have measures in place in terms of from the previous experiences. So I'd say our banks are well placed in Ireland, certainly anyway, to be able to deal with this crisis going into 2021.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, Eileen. And if I may just add for a second some thoughts from a German perspective, I think, yeah, we have rather similar measures, and we have also a similar impact, of course. And looking at, in particular into the internal requirements for banks, which are based, as you may know, on the regulator's framework for dealing with risks, so the so-called and famous MR risk. So the whole systematic of dealings with potential defaults or with existing defaults caused now by COVID-19 is indeed absolutely shaken. Although the banks are released from the relevant reporting obligations for forbearance measures, the strict MR risk rules still apply. So in particular, the question whether banks are required for any measures, the so-called IDWS6, so the restructuring opinion, which is required before any further support can be granted, is still and under really extensive discussions currently. And further, as you may know, the German answer to the scheme of arrangement in the UK has just been implemented by 1st of January. And this now also offers further tools to restructure the debt similar to the UK without an insolvency proceeding. And also this will have, for absolutely clarity, an increase in the pressure on the banks, because they now need to deal with those issues in a far more previous stage. So hopefully these developments will, of course, lead to a more active loan portfolio management by the banks in Germany than for the last decade. So this is something which is currently really under discussion here. So David, back to the UK, where do you see the NPL stock forming in the UK banking system?
Yeah, I mean, thanks, Mike. I think some of your observations, I agree with a lot of your observations there. And I think, you know, how this crisis or how the increase in NPLs will differ as compared to last time round, is that I think we saw NPL stocks post the GFC largely driven by commercial real estate. I think this time, due to the effects, particularly of COVID-19, you know, no sector is untouched. And so I think we're going to see a real diversity of asset class falling within the NPL universe, which I think in itself is probably going to require a much more diversified skill set to deal with the challenges which arise. So completely agree with Eileen that I think from a perspective of bank preparedness, there's a lot of corporate memory within banks from the last GFC. I think where the challenges might arise is ensuring that there is sufficient specialism across the various sectors which might be affected by the increase in NPL stock. So, you know, if you look at something like aviation, you look at certain sectors of manufacturing, for example, which will come under real, real pressure. Are there enough specialists to understand the nature of the underlying issue, either on the bank side, on the sell side, or on the buy side, to promote the transactions which might otherwise see NPLs either worked out or transferred to an appropriate buyer? So I think it's difficult to predict, but I think what my, in terms of actually identifying the subsectors and the like, but what I do know is that I think there's likely to be that diversification which is going to bring its own challenges.
Yeah, and as Eileen has previously mentioned, what are the lessons actually learned from the crisis? So Eileen, Ireland had, I think, a lot of experience for dealing with these issues before. What are the lessons actually you think have been learned?
Yeah, Mike, I had the pleasure, if you like, of dealing with it first time around. So being able to apply it this time around again, didn't think that it would come back around, I suppose, so quickly. But obviously, the COVID-19 has impacted the wider world. So I think this is something that all jurisdictions will need to consider. But yes, as you so mentioned, and as said by David, in the first financial crisis, especially in Ireland, it was centred around commercial real estate and development loans. In the first crisis, we introduced NAMA, which was the bad bank. And that, in hindsight, has actually worked out quite well because it took a lot of the loans off the balance sheets of banks. Now, at the time, there was a lot of discontent about NAMA and what it meant and so forth. But I think with the benefit of hindsight, I think it's, in my opinion, I think that has worked out quite well. The market of NPLs in Ireland, because of the first crisis, is now well established. There is well experienced lawyers in the area, but also service providers. A lot of corporate service providers, a lot of credit servicing firms that are well versed and well used to the consumer legislation and dealing with it. There's now a competitive market for secondary market for NPLs in Ireland. The asset class has evolved originally from, as I said, development loans to now SME loans and to residential property loans as well. Originally, in the first crisis, there was, again, huge discontent with the idea of what was called vulture funds at the time coming in and buying up these loans for a serious write down and that they would be throwing everyone out of their homes. At the time, to be fair, the Irish government acted quickly and ensured that these people that were buying these loans, that they were equally going to have to appoint an entity which would abide by all of the consumer legislation and ensure that the underlying borrower's rights weren't affected. So I think that was actually a very good move at the time. And we have our own credit servicing legislation in Ireland, and that has worked out quite well. So I think the only issue I could see, and much again to David's point, is that the asset classes this time are very different. They are far more diverse. They're much wider. At the time when NAMA was introduced, some would argue that it was cost prohibitive in terms of the actual due diligence that had to be done in order to transfer those loans over. But I do think that a lot of lessons have been learned, and I think, you know, we can definitely put them to use second time round.
Can I just add very quickly, Mike? I absolutely agree, Eileen. And a couple of points that I've observed from just talking to investors in that, you know, there's a hell of a lot of money that's been raised recently over the last couple of years. So there is, you know, considerable dry powder out there waiting for opportunities in this space. And so I think, again, that's maybe slightly different to the global financial crisis. That took a little bit of a time for the bid-ask spread to close on assets. And I think a lot of that was to do with funds not necessarily either having been established or raised the money to deploy into these types of situations. So I think that is something which may cause banks to approach, or sell side to approach, life maybe slightly differently, maybe with slightly more confidence. And the other element is the documentary perspective. So I think particularly in Ireland, there have been a whole series of transactions, and you often see buyers now being very sophisticated around the terms of trade, and or in some instances almost having their own in-house document which they will use for asset purchases. And so, again, that brings some transaction efficiency to bear. But at the same time, the banks themselves on the sell side have that technology too. So those lessons learnt from last time round, and from where things may have gone wrong will be learned around documentation, and the point that Eileen raises around, you know, treating customers fairly, for example, will come under renewed scrutiny, I think, this time round from a documentation perspective and a practical perspective.
Yeah, I agree, David. And I also think as well, the legislation has caught up. Like, it is running at the same time that this crisis is actually running, whereas beforehand, you know, the crisis happened and it wasn't for, you know, a number of months before the legislation came around with, you know, to deal with it. So I do think we are well placed from the lessons we've learned first time around.
Mm. So it's more a question. It's my observation in Germany as well. So it's professionalism has absolutely increased over the last 10 years. So even in Germany, a country where documentation, as David I think also knows from cross border transactions, are very, very difficult to handle. Were difficult to handle for international investors. It must be under German law, very Germanic driven documentation, which was not very internationally and investor-friendly, has absolutely changed. So there's a very professional, matured market now, even in Germany, with an Anglo-Saxon approach. And that is something which I think is a lesson definitely learned by many, many banks, which thought in the past, probably we can document a trade of multi-million NPLs on a two-pager as what was normal in Germany, or what was normal in Germany. And something like that, particularly also the documentation in relation to the assets themselves. So data, which also was a problem always in Germany, proper data which needed to be put in place for the investors to handle this professionally, this has changed as well. And Sébastien, just a look into the French situation on that, because over the last 10 years, France was always a very silent player in the NPL rounds. Will this probably change, or what's your observation on that?
Well, actually, yes, you're right, Mike, and I should say it's an active player. They have been, and what Aileen and David have mentioned, actually, and you have mentioned, Mike, about the crisis and lessons for crisis, is actually quite a curate for France as well. I would say that the Banque de France, for instance, and the French regulator have really insisted on some really high-level potential risk in terms of, notably on commercial real estate assets, on SME loans, residential property loans as well. So they are quite also potentially anxious about the issue related to liquidity. And they have been insisting on that aspect as well. And they have insisted actually on one very important point. And actually, I think that's a very important lesson from crisis, is all the requirement to really scrutinize and monitor very closely the value of assets and collateral, which apparently was not the case always in the past. So really, that will be one of the top priorities here in this crisis, I believe. And certainly the case in other jurisdictions as well, yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, right. So looking also back into the crisis and the solutions which were found in the UK and also in Germany, for example, bad bank systems, so for example. So is this something which may be, well, digged out again as a solution? So putting certain assets of certain banks into certain and special units, carve them out? Or don't we see this issue because it's actually not the bank crisis as such as we had it 10 years ago, is not the issue we are having now? Or is it a similar issue we need to solve, to address? Is a bad bank concept something which will help probably to accelerate the process?
Yeah, like I think it's interesting because the Commission's proposal the NPL action plan that it presented on the 16th of December, it discussed that initially, and it decided that a European-wide, what they're calling national asset management company, wouldn't work. But they were saying that they are on board for supporting and establishing a national bad bank, if you like, to the extent that various countries want to set it up. I suppose from Ireland's perspective, NAMA at the time, it worked with the benefit of hindsight. I think it was a great move. It'd be interesting to see as to whether that could be something that could be looked at for this crisis. And I don't know, it'd be interesting to see if other countries, what your view would be in terms of setting up a bad bank?
Well, as you know, the last crisis presented us Germans the bad banks. So it's like FMS and EAA. And well, I think we never felt in love with these institutions, to be absolutely clear. It costs really a lot of taxpayers' money. But I think this is similar to all other jurisdictions where we saw bad bank concepts. But ultimately, I think that they have achieved what was intended. Yeah? So I wouldn't be surprised if we may also see parts of this concept in the next round, meaning in particular in these cases or for those banks who may really face also their own issues caused by this crisis, whereby, and this is something looking into the structure of the rescue schemes around Europe, in particular here in Germany, we see that these rescue packages are different from last time because the problems are, of course, different. The rescue packages are designed to help the borrowers instead of the banks. Yeah? So we can see so many money which was flooded into, well, flooded in inverted commas, but which was flooded into the market. So for borrowers, for entrepreneurs, for companies to bridge the gap which was caused by COVID-19, to help them to pay the debt to the banks. Yeah? And last time it was different. But of course, as long as this crisis will take and the powder of the governments will probably dry out, because I think at some point in time, even the governments are not able to cover all these losses, in particular if you're looking into a second wave of pandemic, or even a third wave, as other countries are in, then I think this issue may become again an issue of banks, and then we are seeing probably similar concepts like bad banks. Because I don't see my fantasy is lacking of options how to solve these problems otherwise.
Yeah, a few thoughts on that, Mike, and that politically whether there will be the political will to bail out banks as there was kind of last time round, which is effectively done on an emergency basis. So if you look to the UK, it was really done on an emergency basis, and the UK didn't have a bad bank construct, but took a slightly different route to protecting the banking sector. It's a big question to my mind as to whether that's palatable from a political perspective. I think the point we discussed a bit earlier around the diversity of the asset class means that I think the bad bank construct works phenomenally well, as Nama has proved, where you have a concentration of assets within a particular asset class. You can really develop some real deep specialism around that asset and deal with that really efficiently. This time around, maybe slightly different in terms of that diversification of NPLs. So I don't necessarily see there my crystal ball out. I don't necessarily see a bad bank coming in the UK, but there may be some economies which are more focused on a particular sector or very highly geared in a particular sector, bringing that toolkit to bear to deal with NPL issues. But it'll be interesting again. This time round, there's more liquidity out there, so. The solution that came from the state actually might be replaced by private capital, which again, last time round, a lot of the countries around Europe were around Northern Europe were really dealing with a crisis on a very, very much an emergency putting out fires basis.
This brings us to the end of this episode. I'm Mike Danilewski. My thanks to David Ampel, Eileen Johnston, and Sébastien Brochet. And if you would like to discuss in more detail any of the areas covered today, please do get in touch.
Any information in this podcast is for general guidance only and is correct as of the date of recording. This podcast is not intended to be and should not be used as a substitute for taking legal advice in any specific situation. For full terms and conditions, please see our website. If you'd like to hear more of the DLA Piper Financial Services podcast series, subscribe now through your usual podcast app.